I am a poor wayfaring stranger, while traveling through this world of woe. Yet there's no sickness, toil, or danger in that bright world to which I go. I know dark clouds
Hello and welcome to Tea Time Theology. My name is Ivy Swinsky.
Hello everyone, my name is Dwayne Keys with Church of the Redeemer.
And today we are talking to Mr. Wilmar Jennings. Thank you so much for being with us today. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about what you're here to talk about?
Well, I was born and raised in Providence in 1938. And I'll talk about myself in conjunction with the church. I was baptized at the Church of the Savior at Christmas of 1938. And I was confirmed there in 1951 by Bishop Bennett. And between 1952 and 55, my mother decided to enroll us at the Cathedral of St. John, and so I was there for those 3 years and saw the end of Bishop Bennett's term and the beginning of Bishop Higgins. But they needed someone at Savior to play the organ, and it turned out that I had studied the piano and I learned the touch. Organ touch, and their organ was an electronic organ that did not have foot pedals, which was a good thing because I had a difficult time doing foot pedals because my foot was wide. So I did that off and on until the end of 1959, when a decision was made to merge Savior with the Cathedral of St. John. So we marched down the hill and joined St. John's the first Sunday in 60, I think. Now, that's my church history. I also studied, I went to school in Providence, Henry Barnard School, then Classical High School, and the old Classical High School, and then Brown, and I graduated. I majored in psychology, decided to do graduate work in experimental psychology, not clinical. I put in a year and a half at the University of Portland in Oregon, went to Rutgers, finished my graduate work there. I worked with rats in Skinner boxes. Not a very relevant thing, but it was something that I was interested in at the time. And then taught 2 years at Fresno State College in California, and then 6 years at Howard University. I was at Howard from 66 to 74. Those were tumultuous years. The students were more interested in protesting than in learning, it seemed to me, during that time. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with my life. I spent a year in having therapy with a an analyst. And the one thing that I decided to do finally was to change fields. I had been interested in architecture years earlier in high school. So I went back to school as an undergraduate, earned an undergraduate, a Bachelor of Arts in Architecture at the University of New Mexico, and then a Master of Architecture at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I couldn't find a job in the private sector, came back to Providence. It's been 6 months or so. My uncle, who had worked for the federal government, advised me to look for a federal job. And I was offered a position with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Anchorage, Alaska in 1981. I went up there and put in 22 years. I never, though, became a professional architect because the local people in the field of architecture said that because your apprenticeship was training was with an engineering firm, you're not eligible to take the architectural record examination. But I didn't care. I did the work of an architect. I acquired federal pensions and such, retired in 03 and moved back to Providence. Now, all during those years, from 1960 on to 2003, I had not been active in church. Mm-hmm. Now and then I went if I was visiting relatives or I went to a funeral, that kind of thing. In 06, my mother suggested that I join the Cathedral of St. John, and I did. And I was down there for the last 6 years of that parish, and I watched them spin their way into insolvency.
Yeah.
Went down the merry path, spending their endowment right and left, and of course Bishop Wolfe pulled the plug on them, mm-hmm. which she did with all the other churches that spent their endowments. So we were cast out of our building in April 22nd, I think it was, of 12. And I had visited Grace Church during one of their open hours. I came up the hill and looked at All Saints Memorial to see when they were open, but they weren't at that time. I then backtracked, came up the hill, past St. Stephen's. I was impressed by the fact that they had services every day, and I'm a high churchman anyway, but I did not like having to be in the Brown University neighborhood. The students, I never liked it as an undergraduate, and I looked up at the statue of St. Stephen in their guild hall gable, and I noticed that they had protected it with clear plastic, and I said, aha, that's to protect it from snowballs thrown by Brown University students. Anyway, I decided to go to All Saints Memorial because I was curious to see what the church looked like inside. So I joined that church on April 29th, and I have been there ever since.
Great.
Yeah. So that's my church history. Now, as far as the Church of the Savior is concerned, my mother's father took his family to St. Augustine's mission, and even though his family was active at St. Stephen's, he decided that he would rather go to the St. Augustine's mission.
Can you tell us where that was?
Yes. The Augustine's mission was on the corner of Broad and Fenner Streets. Hmm. In a white church that had been, which they rented. And eventually that church was torn down and replaced by the building that's there now. I think it was a Roman, it was built for the Roman Catholic Church, but I understand that I'm pretty sure now that Johnson and Wales is in there. At any rate, the Episcopal Diocese of Rhode Island moved St. Augustine's mission to the vacant building on Benefit Street. And it kept the name Church of the Savior, as I talked about earlier, because Mrs. Vinton, who had founded the Church of the Savior, wanted a church called that in memory of her children. Mm-hmm. But then the congregation that was there merged with Calvary Deformed, St. Martin's, I think. The church building was already there. Calvary was already there, and they acquired the name St. Martin's, leaving a vacant building. And so I guess the diocese felt that that would be a good place for St. Augustine's mission. At the time, it was served by a number of different visiting clergy. Now, a very important person in the founding of Church of the Savior, as it became, was P.G. Moore Brown, Percival George Moore Brown. The Reverend Percival George Moore Brown was a Methodist minister. He was born in Barbados. His wife came from British Guiana. And I think he first served at a church in New Haven and then came to Providence to Bethel AME. But after he arrived in Providence, he was interested in becoming an Episcopal priest and worked with Bishop Perry to do that. And I think that he was probably when a priest is, it isn't consecration, it's, they don't use the word consecration, it's
ordained,
yes. Okay. He was ordained an Episcopal priest in late 1917, and I think that he was still not a priest yet when he gave this little book to my grand aunt Bessie. And it says, I can read this. Awarded to Miss Margaret Wilson for bringing more scholars than any other person to St. Augustine's mission. P.G. Moore Brown, Superintendent Sunday School, April 1917. Well, by that time they were at the Church of the Savior. He called it St. Augustine's Mission. And if he's the superintendent of the Sunday School, he wasn't yet the ordained priest there. So I think his ordination probably occurred later in 17. And I have here somewhere a picture of the interior. I just don't have things well organized. Oh, here it is. It's very faint. But you can see what the church looked like on the inside. It had two side aisles, but not a center aisle.
Can you describe a little for us what the church looked like? Was it like white walls, very clean in that way? Or is it one of those like big, like St. Stephen's you had talked about at one point?
No, it's a small, relatively small wood building, I think. Or maybe it isn't wood, but it's not a large building. I would consider that to be an open hall type building. It doesn't have transepts, for example. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think of the term that you would use for buildings that developed in England in the 1600s. I can't think of the term. But anyway, it's open. And you can see that there are a couple of places. There's an organ over here, an lectern there, and so on. But the people at the Church of the Savior felt, looking back, those were the good years.
Mm.
They had a flourishing group there. It was in the 1920s. The Depression hadn't yet gotten started and so on. And they looked back with fondness at their the church that they had at that time. Well, during the early 30s, I guess the diocese needed money, and they sold that building to the Barker Playhouse and moved them to a vacant church on Broadway that has a very orange yellow stone. It's prominent that way, and they were there for a few years. Then the diocese sold that to an Armenian congregation, which still has it today, St. Fatinans, and moved the church to the Chapel of the Annunciation up the hill attached to the Cathedral of St. John. They were not given that as a home necessarily. It's a place where they worshiped. St. Dunstan's choir school up the hill also used the church at times. And so they had a place where they could lock up their things. I can remember an altar guild member, Miss Lena Nelson, would remove certain candlesticks that belonged to the Church of the Savior and put them away at the end of the service.
Mr. Jennings, when the diocese made these decisions to like sell property, sell the building, and tell the mission to go to this location, was there any conversation about what you wanted, what they wanted, or was it like an order, just like we made the decision and you're going to do this or go here, or you're going to worship here?
I think that it was a decision made by the diocese. They had difficult times at that point, financially and so on. And when they did move the Church of the Savior worshiped there, but they also at the same time purchased a house on North Main Street, a few houses north of Oney on the east side of North Main, that had a store on a commercial space on the basement. And then you went up some steep steps to the second level, and that's where they had a large room, like a large living dining room combination that could serve as a small chapel. And Sunday school classes were held there. They had movable chairs, and so they would have the Sunday school classes in groups around in that room. They also had a small altar, and Father Moore Brown would conduct services there, and a kitchen and so on. And there was an upstairs, I never went upstairs, but presumably that also was usable space. And so most of the parish life occurred there, and they had an annual TEA. And they were allowed, they got permission from the Cathedral of St. John to use their parish hall. Yeah, on the same level as the church. So you could walk from the Chapel of the Annunciation down the stairs through the Cathedral of St. John's worship space and then to their parish hall. At the time, the Cathedral of St. John had a parish house. Now, eventually that was taken down in the 1960s. Now, finally, they built a new church for the Church of the Savior next door to this house on the south side of it. It was a simple concrete masonry unit or cinder block building with a basement, and you went up the stairs into the building itself. It was very simple. You could see the they gave the church unpainted concrete masonry unit. Eventually, they painted it. And the organ, of course, I've already said, is electronic. And was it electronic, I should say. And that's where they held their the church. And the Church of the Savior was, they had a high church ceremonial.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can remember a holy water stoop where you put your fingers in as you come in and make the sign of the cross. And they had incense and so forth. And they were sort of allied with St. Stephen's in that respect. Now, Father Moore Brown retired. They built the church in 08, in 48. It was, Father retired, Father Moore Brown retired in 49. And his family moved to McVicker House, a red brick building on the west side of Benefit at the top of Star Street. And that became part of Hallworth House when they built Hallworth House.
Yeah.
But at that time, it was McVicker House was a house for retired clergy. And after Father Moore Brown died in 1958, his widow and daughter moved to one of the houses, I think they call them the Richardson houses, the houses that are on the west side of Benefit, south of there, going down to Church Street. And Mrs. Moore Brown died in, I think, 66. And her daughter eventually rented an apartment next door to us in a house owned by my parents. She would rather live there than on Benefit Street. And my grand aunt Bessie lived upstairs with my grandmother. And Enid eventually died of cancer in 78, and Aunt Bessie moved downstairs in her apartment and stayed there. And then Aunt Bessie had to go to a nursing home in 86, and my mother had to clean out the apartment and eventually rent it. And one of the things that they had, I happened to be there at the time, and I asked for one of Father Moore Brown's crosses, namely this one. It hangs, you can just make a nail and hang it on the wall that way. And it consists of metal pieces, well, that fit together, rabbited in the wood. I think that's probably, it looks to me, it's lightweight. I'm willing to bet it's aluminum, but I'm not entirely sure. But I like it because it's a mixture of metal, high polished metal, and wood, natural wood. And I've had it on my wall. I took it back with me to Alaska, and I had it on my wall there, and I have it in my wall in Providence as well. But that was one of the crosses that hung in Father Moore Brown's living room. And, I'm talking about it from the Moore Brown perspective. After Father Moore Brown left, he was replaced by Father Victor Holly, who came from Haiti. And he was the grandson of Bishop Holly, who founded the Episcopal Church in Haiti. But Father Holly, he had four sons, I think, and he was married four sons. They didn't really do things. It was somewhat haphazard and so on. A number of people left the church. My mother said that she would rather have us go to the Cathedral of St. John. So, and she knew people who were there already. And so I was there during the Holly years.
Oh, can you say more about that? So just to give, I'm going to give like the listeners context. So Church of the Savior, just everyone was predominantly Black, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
It was founded as, quote, a colored mission, unquote.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah, and I can remember when a white family showed up there once. They weren't sure what kind of a church it was, and the people were surprised to see them. And they stayed for the service,
yeah.
But it was a, yeah.
Okay. Or did they ever come back? Or
no.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I find that fascinating that there was things going on, so your mother was like, I'll rather send you down to Cathedral than to...
Well, she didn't like the way Father Holly was doing things, and she already knew the people at the Cathedral. See, the Cathedral of St. John already had a small number of African families.
Okay.
Going way back, and if you look at the history of St. John's, when they built the church... In the early 1800s, they had a fairly large balcony that mirrored the dome above.
Mm-hmm.
They started narrow in the middle and then out like this. And people of African descent and Indians had to sit up there in the balcony at that time. And I think that the First Baptist Church was also doing things like that. But when they remodeled the Cathedral of St. John in the early 1900s, they took out the balcony except for a choir loft. And there were African families, African-American families, going way back at the Cathedral of St. John. So it was not a whites-only church. It was predominantly white. So my mother felt comfortable going there. And as a teenager, I was invited to join the Acolytes Guild, and a lot of my training came from Dean Charles Brooks. I found out how to do certain things, and they also had a Young People's Fellowship and so forth. But because I had musical training, I was invited to go back to Savior to play their organ. Now, at that, Holly only stayed there about 5 years.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he was replaced by a young fellow named Kenneth Higginbotham, who was there from, I guess, the middle 50s, just for a few years. I'll say that much. I think he came there in probably 55, and he lasted just through 58. He decided that he would rather go to the District of Columbia and be a counselor at the new Federal City College. And so for the last 2 years, they were served by temporary clergy at Savior. And now a decision was made to tear down most of that area.
Yeah, because back then they talk about with Providence. And so for me, I've lived in Providence since 99.
Yeah.
And coming here, there's a history that many of us, even been here a quarter of a century, still don't know. So when we hear now stories that there was like urban renewal policies, and so we hear like where University Heights is,
yes,
that was all predominantly Black families that were living there as a church. So, you know, from what I've heard is that right around the same time that this decision made, you had all this development that was happening and the city of Providence saying, we're going to redevelop or, you know, fix up these properties or say that we're going to make this land for a different purpose other than what it was being used now.
Yes, and the interesting thing is that area also had Jewish families.
Mm-hmm.
And there was even a synagogue back in there about where Staples is.
Yes. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and there was a Corb's Bakery further up. And by the way, Redeemer began in that area.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Along that, in fact, I got a chance to do research on family research in the archives at City Hall, and you can see the plat for 1875, and Redeemer was along there.
Mm-hmm.
They hadn't yet moved here.
Yeah.
And so about where Redeemer was where Corb's Bakery was, and so on. So it was sort of racially mixed, but overwhelmingly African-American. And so they tore down most of it, but not all of it. For example, Carrington Avenue, parts of Howell Street and so on are still there. Doyle Avenue is there. But they took most of it. And in my opinion, the Episcopal Diocese of Rhode Island could have continued, found another place for Savior.
Mm.
But instead, they decided to take the money that they got and use it for other purposes, and merge St. Savior with St. John's down the hill.
So, if we're correct, so they made the decision, the diocese made the decision to close Savior, and took the money that from that sale of that building, the property. So there was no discussion, not only not finding another place to decide to merge with the cathedral.
I think it was done very nicely.
Yeah.
I think my mother used to say that Bishop Higgins was all business.
Oh, okay.
And he said he told the congregation that he didn't want to continue it. He wanted to have a racially integrated situation. He didn't want a, and so that happened. And I think if you look at the history of African American Episcopal congregations. In much of the country, not the South, but outside the South,
yeah.
You'll find that the people, that they were founded by African Americans,
mm-hmm.
and not the Board of White Church. For example, St. Luke's New Haven, and of course St. Thomas in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and St. Philip's in New York, and so on. So I think it was Bishop Perry who began Savior as a mission to the colored people, and it was Bishop Higgins who decided to integrate. And so they merged this with St. John's. There was a march down the hill. I took part in that. And but within 2 or 3 years, They had two different services on Sunday, the early service, the later service. The early service was overwhelmingly white. The later service was both black and white. So you get this kind of thing. And I remember seeing that after I used to come back. I used to try to go to church whenever I visited my relatives. And I think it developed that way. But by the late 1900s, the later service was the main service, and the early service didn't have that many people. And so it was a racially integrated service situation anyway.
Okay.
And then we also had there a number of Liberians mm-hmm. who joined the church, St. John's, and people from Nigeria as well.
Yeah.
And so that was, it was African-American, it was white, and it was African-African.
Yeah. I mean, what was the reaction, you know, just from people who are members of the Church of the Savior, like when you hear the announcement, you're told, okay, we're closing down the church, you're going to become members of the cathedral, emerge the cathedral, like what was the reaction from the members, if you can remember?
I think they were sort of resigned because they had a difficult time finding another priest after Higginbotham left.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't all go to the cathedral. Yeah. Some went to other churches. Some went to St. Stephen's. Some people who lived in East Providence. I know of a family that joined St. Michael and All Angels, and so on. But I think whenever you close a church, you lose some people. Mm-hmm. And I think it happened there, and I think it happened at St. John's as well. A number of people didn't, just sort of disappeared after St. John's closed.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a lot of similarities between the experience of closing Church of the Savior and, because you lived through two closures, that one and then also the cathedral one?
Yes, I think so. Whenever people get used to doing certain things, and when you change, they're not entirely sure. And at one time, I was looking at my mother, who was active in the Women's Auxiliary to the National Council in the 1950s, had these annual reports, and I think as many as 14 Episcopal churches existed in Providence at that time.
Mm.
And I think now we're down to 6.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and I don't think any of them have the number. Now, this church, what is your overall...
For Church of the Redeemer?
Yes.
Dwayne, do you know that number? I definitely don't.
You mean as of our membership?
Yes.
We're talking between, I would say, like 40 to 60. So within that range. So we've also, like during the pandemic, have had a decrease and things have changed. People have moved. People have passed away.
Yeah.
So there is definitely been a decline, but now a resurgence as... restrictions, obviously, the COVID restrictions are not on us, as where people are being coming out and about, and people are moving into the neighborhoods. So.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, at All Saints Memorial, I guess, we may have about 125 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And the ASA is in the high 40s.
Yeah.
And I guess the pledged income is in the 80,000s.
Mm-hmm.
But we recently had people from a fairly well-to-do family left $600,000, so I think they now have an endowment of about $2 million, and they get interest from that, and they rent the place out to a city meal site, and there's a small Lutheran congregation there too, Hispanic Lutheran. So they're getting by.
Yeah.
But it's a large building, very large, and they have an old slate roof. You occasionally see slate shingles that have come off,
mm-hmm.
and it's a brownstone building with sheds, shards of stone, and so on. So they have a major upkeep problem there.
Okay.
But they're surviving.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you actually kind of, I think we may want to fast forward to like the cathedral closing, because this one is where I had been attending Grace Church. So I was a member around that time. And so I do remember then hearing about the issues, finances, and possible closure. And I was very confused because I'm like, well, isn't that the location where the bishop is there, like leading? Like, so I was confused about that closure, but I do remember just hearing the impacts of people just very upset about the closure, and then referencing how they had been at Church of the Savior that was closed and merged, and now you're closing this church, and where are we to go? So I definitely want to just kind of fast forward to that scenario, that experience that you had referenced earlier.
Well, it was difficult. I was at the cathedral during the years when they were spending money wildly.
Mm.
And like, there was no tomorrow. And everyone full time, and we have to buy this, we have to buy that, and so forth. They did do a little, they did put a new roof on, and some other things like that, fix some windows. But the church continued to deteriorate. And so it was no surprise to me that they would close. And I was determined to find another church, and I did. One of the things at the Cathedral of St. John that I had gotten involved in was they had a food pantry. So I used to bring large amounts of food to the food pantry. I continued doing that when I went over to All Saints, and I continue to do it. Although they don't have a food pantry, they collect food that goes to two other food pantries. And I'm still involved in that. So I have I see that I have a mission. If only to bring food, if nothing else, and show up and participate and so on. And tomorrow is the annual meeting. I'll find out how they did during the last year.
Oh, great, great. Yes.
Do you have any favorite memories of the Cathedral or Church of the Savior?
Any what?
Favorite memories of either of those places.
Oh, yes. I can remember Savior when they were at the Cathedral of St. John's Chapel of the Annunciation, being there on Palm Sunday and Easter and so on. And of course, we were close to the Moore Brown family. So I have a lot of positive memories about that. And also at the Cathedral of St. John, I remember how they were doing things in the 1950s. And it was much larger than the congregation, I think. I can remember at Easter time, they would have three services of Holy Communion. They would consecrate the wine, the bread and the wine, at the first service, and then reserve it for the next two, and leave the candlelight burning to show that the Eucharist was present, and much larger at that time than it ended up being in the. But even when the church closed, they had more than 300 people. Mm-hmm. So I think that they could have allowed the church to have become a mission temporarily, with the understanding that they would cut the staff to half-time staff and all that, and see how they would do. But that was not Bishop Wolfe's way of doing things.
No.
And I think that Bishop, the new bishop, Bishop Nisley, pretty much accepted things as they were, and then they talked about the reuse of the cathedral, and they had the Center for Reconciliation. Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what happened to that. I think that during the COVID crisis, much of what they were doing was programs where they would invite people to come there for various mm-hmm. things, and yeah. when the COVID crisis hit, I think that they probably cut back a lot. Just what they're doing now, I don't know. But there is another group that still meets there, the Church Beyond the Walls.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they still have that. But just what's going to happen there, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And they definitely need to a major renovation of the building, yeah. especially yeah. the upper portion. The last time I was there, you could see pieces of plaster falling, and that's heavy plaster. Mm. You obviously can't have people using yeah. the space with plaster falling on them.
Yeah. No, it's a good boundary yeah. to have. Yeah. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to tell us about, either your story or any of those churches that you know the history of?
Well, no, not really. there's a lot of speculation that, you know, that you can do. I just wish that they would find a good use for the Cathedral of St. John sometime in the near future before it completely collapses or something. And I think that it's Bishop Knisley's responsibility to try to do that and not just accept things as they are.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. If everyone's listening, all the artifacts that Mr. Jenny mentioned, we'll have pictures of that on our social media accounts. So feel free to look us up on Facebook and Instagram where those pictures will be. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you also very much as well. This is very fascinating and I'm learning more as I'm listening. So thank you for sharing.
I'm going there to see my father. I'm going there no more to roam. I'm only going over Jordan. I'm only going over home. I'm going there to see Savior, to sing his praise forevermore. I'm only going over Jordan. I'm only going over home.
Thank you for listening to Tea Time Theology, a ministry of St. John's Cathedral in Rhode Island. We would like to thank our producers, Ivy Swinsky and Taylor Wilkie. Special thanks to Mario Akande and David Hines for this season's music. Additionally, we would like to thank Dwayne Keyes for co-hosting this season and the Reverend Patrick Campbell for consulting this season. Our sponsor, the Episcopal Diocese of Rhode Island, and the Right Reverend Nicholas Knisley, as well as our guest today. Follow us at Tea Time Theology on all social medias.